This is a podcast of ABC Radio National's Late Night Live. This program can be heard broadcast or streamed from ABC Radio National. Details of frequencies, times and more downloads, abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to Highlights of LNL on ABC Radio National Summer. In this program, and all next week, we're taking you back to the Murray. It's a journey we took 15 months ago from its beginning in the Snowy Mountains through to its end in Lake Alexandrina in South Australia, and although modesty should forbid, I have to tell you that it won a United Nations Media Award. So whack on your flippers and let's head for the Great River. The sound you can hear in the background is not a sound effect. It's not just something out of the library at the ABC. It's the real dinky-dye thing. And the thing it is the Murray. We're very close to its beginnings here. We're on a bridge called the Indy. And over there, amongst those willows, that's Victoria. And over there, near those moo cows, that's New South Wales. Now, OK, the Murray isn't as famous or as majestic, even at its best, as the Mississippi or the Amazon or the Nile or the Ganges. But I'll tell you what, it's every bit as important to our country as any of those rivers are to theirs. It's of crucial importance. It draws water in, rainwater in, from a vast system, the Murray Darling. And theoretically, it channels it all the way down sinuously between New South Wales and Victoria, through South Australia, to spill out into the ocean. Well, of course, it hasn't been doing much of that spilling lately, and the river tells a very sad story as it progresses from this point of stunning beauty to where it finishes up. So for the week we're going to follow the Murray, we're going to follow it as far as it goes, and we're going to tell its story as we travel. We're going to talk about its history, we're going to talk about aspects of Murray River culture, and we're certainly going to talk about Murray River politics, because of course the whole Murray Darling issue is now central to this country. If we can't save this river, there's very little chance of us saving any aspect of our continent. So we'll be talking to people who farm along the river, who fish along the river, who've grown up along the river, or who are bureaucratically responsible for the river. And we're going to start the day by going upstream just a few hundred yards, actually, to a beautiful dairy farm. I can see it in the distance. And it's run these days by Lorna Hogg and one of her many children. Now, Lorna's 82. She's lived here since she was 5 years old. She and husband Len ran cattle in the high country. Not allowed to do that anymore, and I'm sure she'll have something to say about that. But Lorna's going to tell us all about her life and times and about what the river means to her. Because it leaves here in pristine condition. At this point, the Murray couldn't be better, healthier. The water couldn't be sweeter. But what happens to it as it goes downstream is really a tragedy. But one thing, I wonder if she knows, because I've just discovered that none of us know. Who the hell is Murray? Or was Murray? Here's this famous river named after a bloke. None of us. I've got the foggiest idea who it was. So if she doesn't know, we'll have to find someone who does. There's some lift. It's a dairy farm, this one. Yeah, it's almost done with chainsaw sculpture. Early morning, very bright blue cloudless sky, and I'm sitting here in a sun-filled kitchen having tea and muffins with Lorna Hogg, who's aged 82, and you've been here just about forever, haven't you, Lorna? When did you arrive?
12th of July 1927.
I'm told you remember it quite vividly as a five-year-old girl.
I do remember it very vividly because the road wasn't like it is now by any manner of means. It was just a dirt track. And where you have come around the river down there a few miles, that was more bends in it than a snake track. And I remember it very vividly, and it was a really cold, bleak July day. That's what I remember about it.
And muddy?
Oh, muddy underfoot, yes. And did you come over Tawan Gap this morning? Well, I well remember that. We had to get out and walk down along where the fence is now, where the track was, because the truck was could quite easily have slipped over. So he unloaded us and we all walked down to...
Mum, Dad, brother, grandmother.
No, Mum, grandmother, brother. Dad had ridden up to Bigra beforehand. Don't think he wasn't with us when we came up that day, I'm sure.
I understand that you and Mum and Grandma all slept in a double bed that night, and the bloke slept on the floor by the fire.
That's right.
And do you remember it clearly after all this time?
Well, I remember that.
How did the family make a quid in the beginning, in the early days?
Brawn. Hard work. I think Dad brought up 11 cows with him, and it was a drought year, and six of them died. So there was a lot of hard work, and one of the first things he did was put in an orchard and a garden. That was his first job, and fenced it in. And there's still some of those old trees still left up there. But we wouldn't, as I said to one of the doctors one day, we were having a discussion, I said we never had any money to spare, but I can never, ever remember being hungry. But then again, there was rabbits everywhere and kangaroos, wild ducks. There was no closed season as far as we were concerned. I mean, you wouldn't shoot a mother duck if she had... They'd make sure they went for the drake or something like that. Or a mother kangaroo either, but sometimes that was done accidentally. I can remember we had a pet fox, a pet kangaroo, pet wallaroo.
When you were 12, you meet a really nice bloke at a neighbour's place, a piano tuner.
Oh, sugar, I ended up marrying him, but not then.
I find it hard to imagine that a piano tuner could make a living up here.
Well, he didn't make a living up here. That gentleman travelled. He came from Wagga, originally from a place called Oura, which is out of Wagga. They lived, as he did when he was a child. But he travelled all over New South Wales, up to Young and even as far as Gooduga and way up Bourke. All those places.
So most people have a piano because, of course, there's no television, no radio.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I can remember him telling me his old home in Wagga, where everybody used to congregate on Sunday nights and they'd have a big sing-song. And that went on, and this is what happened. It was a place over the hill from here. We used to ride around there. People used to go around there Sunday night. They had a piano and the old chap used to play an accordion. There was music everywhere.
So you marry this guy. How old are you when you marry him?
Oh, sugar, about 19 or something like that. I was 19 when my first child was born. I know that.
You had six kids, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Do you want to see the photo of them?
Love to later. Love to later. Lorna, you have six kids together, and you lose your husband in a tractor accident, which of course were and remain all too common in the bush in Australia. After you lost your husband, It must have been incredibly difficult with all the kids.
It was, but I had the whole district behind me.
Everybody helped?
Oh, fantastic. I couldn't have done it on my own. I remember going into the doctor one day with a sick child and he said, I believe you're going to Melbourne. I said, what on earth would I do in Melbourne with six children? I said, I'm stopping right where I am. I said, I know everybody here and everybody knows me and that's that.
Tell us about Len, your second husband. You've got a lovely face. I've got a photograph of him here on his 90th birthday.
Practical joker from Go to Woe.
He's got a very mischievous face, cheeky grin, and you say he was a practical joker.
I'm going to tell you some colossal jokes he played at people.
Dear, oh dear, oh dear.
Well, I'll tell you one he did to his mother. The jokes he used to play on her, she loved to fish. She used to go down to the river, and she'd put her line in, and she'd sit down there. And I don't know whether she read or how she filled in the time, but she used to stay there, and then one day he sneaked down. Remember the old kerosene tins you would, with the lids? Sneaked down there one day while she was up having lunch and she'd left her line in the river, tied a tin lid onto it. Down she went, oh, I've got something, she said. You little wretch. That's what she called him, little wretch. Oh, he was a practical joker and he did it all his life.
So in one minute I can see the tears in your eyes and the next minute they're tears of laughter, but you had, what, 47 years together? It's a long time.
It is a long time.
How many kids?
Two.
You and Len had cattle and you had a snow leaser.
Oh, yes, that was way up the river.
Tell us about the great saga of cattle in the high country, because I know that these days they're not there anymore.
No, they're not. Worse luck. They kept the place open. You could ride up there through the scrub. And, well, it was different altogether to what it is now, and you would have to have known it back in those...
So you think the policy of pulling the cattle out has been bad for the mountains?
I certainly do. It was possible to ride through that country over a lot of it. I mean, the steep places you wouldn't even attempt to ride.
Lorna, I know that you and Len didn't flog your part.
We didn't.
You didn't overgraze, but were there people that did?
I don't think so. I don't really think so. Really, I don't. Most of those people, they'd take the cattle up there in the spring after the snows had gone. They'd graze through the mountains. And cattle know where the food is. They'd go from spot to spot. And in the autumn, they'd bring them all down to the low country again. They wouldn't be up there in the dead of winter. But anyway.
So you think it was people from the city who didn't begin to understand the nature of the region?
I'm sure they didn't. I am quite sure.
The Murray leaves the district here in pretty good shape. It looks very beautiful as it heads down. Are you upset about what happens to it downstream?
Well, what I think about it downstream, they have used it to capacity, or more than capacity, because that irrigation, they certainly opened up a lot of land, which was fantastic, but I think they've overstepped their mark with it, and I think they are addressing it now, the problem, because with the irrigation channels they had, a lot of that water would be wasted because, oh well, I suppose some through evaporation and so forth. But I'm not an expert on those sort of things, but I know they're altering their plans now.
But you also know the river over 80 years of your life, and you've seen it
That river down there is clear as crystal, and one gentleman who was holidaying on the farm years ago dropped his keys in water as he was going walking down the river, fishing as he went, retraced his steps, and I dare say he would have been about a quarter of a mile down, further down the stream, when he realised he'd lost his keys. He came back up the river and he found them. Now,
in the water.
In the water.
Hmm.
So that's...
You'd be hard-pressed to find your car in the water downstream these days.
Well, I was amazed the first time I went down to Albury and saw the river down there. It was just, you couldn't see through it. I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't. To leaving, you know, such a clear stream up here. And there's still, the people up here care about that river. They really do.
Well, I know you do. I hear that despite the fact that you're 82 and counting, that you're walking a kilometre a day, road testing your new hip.
I've been doing that walking. I go down there a kilometre and I walk a kilometre back. I've only just, the last week or so, I've made that kilometre. I didn't do it all.
Lorna, given your love of the river, you should be swimming. Okay, it's a bit cold at the moment. Lorna, thanks very much for seeing us. It's been lovely. The muffins were terrific. The tea was great. It's good to meet you.
Thank you. Good to meet you people too. You've got a twinkle in your eye. I'm used to twinkles in eyes.
It's a marvellous noise, isn't it? The sound
beautiful,
of a river.
Soothing. You could just imagine. You come down here and sit down here. You can understand how Len's mum used to love to get the fish. And see how clear it is?
Good heavens, if I toss the car keys in there, Lorna, I'd be able to see them a mile off, I reckon.
Well, you would be able to see them. And that's where I reckon that gentleman that I was telling you about that found his car keys, I reckon he'd come down here to fish.
You could probably catch a trout if you had your car keys on a bit of string, I reckon. We'll try that later, Lorna. Oh, she thumped me. Run for your lives, Gladys. The dam wall is leaking. Oh, it's meant to. This is where some of the Murray comes out through this huge dam wall in the Hume, and it goes through. Does it go through this little hydroelectric scheme? It does, and makes a contribution to our grid. We're on that. Let's wander over here. Out of the wind. I want to read you a great big pompous brass plaque here. There we go. Hume Reservoir. This tablet serves to commemorate the turning of the first sod. Isn't that a good term, the first sod? By, here we go, His Excellency the Right Honourable Sir Ronald Crawford Munro-Ferguson, PC, GCMG, Governor-General and Commander-in-Chief. They don't use that much now, do they? You don't think of the Governor-General as being the boss of the armed services of the Commonwealth of Australia on the 28th day of November 1919. And it goes on to list the history of this fine construction. Over this side, you can see where I'm pointing, listeners, that's a huge amount of water, all dammed up. I'm told it is equivalent in volume to 8 Sydney harbours. Because of the drought, there's probably a couple of Sydney harbours missing. The other side, turn around, look into Wireless's, there you see. That's where the Murray goes after it's extruded through that little hole you can hear in the background. It's very pretty down there. Up in the Weir, of course, there's all these poor, sad, drowned trees all waving their little branches in the air. I think they're mainly river red gums and a couple of yellow boxes. Now, Gladys, what we've got to ask ourselves and the experts is, was this a great idea? Is the Hume Weir Dam Reservoir Lake the best idea in the history of water management, or has it been an immense slow-motion calamity, or is it a bit of both? We're going to wander up the road and have a chat to David Doll. David's the acting chief executive, Murray-Darling Commission, but he's handing over the torch to a new boss this very day. David, given your immense history in the business, the politics, the worries of water, I could pretty much call you Old Man River. You've retired once already, you're about to retire again.
Yes, that's correct, Philip. My current password on the computer is Lazarus.
Now, I want you to go back a couple hundred years earlier in your career, okay? And I know that, well, we can't go back that far, but we can go back fairly reliably in terms of data, 120 years.
That's about right. We have some records, of course, from the 1850s, but they really only started in the late 1800s when people really started to focus on the reality of Australia being the driest continent, and limits of water became very real.
Well, what do those figures tell us about the old flow from the Murray? How much water was getting down to the mouth 120 years ago?
Well, about four times what happens today. About, on average, about 12,000 gigalitres of water pass through the mouth. Today it's somewhere between 3 and 4.
Well, it's not the Mississippi, and it's not the Nile or the Ganges, but it's still a substantial river, isn't it, the Murray?
Oh, yes. Yes, it's very substantial. It drains about 1 million square kilometres, which is a very large area. It's very long, 2,300 kilometres in length, and it's got a tributary even longer, the Darling. But the difference between the Murray and a stream of a similar grandeur in another part of the world is that the Australia being the driest continent, we see quite long periods of low flow. So the ratio between the high flow and the low flow is quite high. And shortage of water, I think, has always been that event that has stirred the minds and interests of people who've spent much time on the river.
Well, that's why I'm encouraged, because the river has the chance of doing a Lazarus, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I think many people would look at the river today and say, well, where's the problem? It looks majestic. It looks beautiful in many places. But you don't have to look very far into the river environment to see shallowing of the bed, the loss of riverine vegetation, particularly on the higher benches of the floodplain, which get less frequent flooding than they did under natural conditions. The mortality of long-lived trees, the red gum, is quite significant. And loss of native fish species is another indicator. So there's plenty of indications. We don't think the Murray mouth, at least in the last few hundred years, would ever have closed. But it has closed under our management in the 80s, and we've been living on the edge of closure for the last couple of years.
Now, there have been attempts to manage going way back to the early colonial days, haven't there?
Yes.
In the beginning, I understand New South Wales grabbed the river, but then a deal was cut between New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia.
The first major step in management that followed that action by New South Wales to take the whole of the river was the River Murray Waters Agreement. And that came out of a very strong response from the communities of the River Murray at the time of the Federation drought. So the 1902 drought sequence is very similar to the one we've experienced in 2002, just accidentally 100 years later. And that led to a meeting at Corowa, which called parliamentarians together, and out of that came a determination to reach an agreement on the sharing of the waters of the Murray. It took about 15 years for that to be resolved.
That was an agreement for humans to share.
That's right.
The Murray. It wasn't a conservation plan as such.
No, it was a very pragmatic solution between three states, with the Commonwealth acting as the glue, in effect, to settle a problem which perhaps in many other parts of the world hasn't been easily settled. In fact, nation states go to war over these problems, as we know. But they reached a compact which resulted in a sharing of waters between three states on a formula that it largely has survived to today. So whilst it was only between humans, it was still a very resilient decision.
David, were there at the time, going back to the late 19th, early 20th century, models for water management elsewhere in the world? Were there compacts, agreements that were helping minimise problems for the Tigris and the Euphrates and the Mississippi or anywhere?
I don't think there was anything quite as bold as this, where states that had the determination that they were in fact sovereign in regard to land and water were prepared to modify those rights to the extent that it was balanced by benefit. So I think in many ways it was a model, and in subsequent years we've found nation states in other parts of the world, and more particularly, say, in recent years, the Mekong countries have looked at our model and said, well, there's something to be learned from this.
So we were getting the railways wrong. We were getting, at that stage, the rivers right.
Up to the point, I think, that you made earlier, where we saw water sharing as a matter that was basically determined by its value for human consumption and creation of wealth. I don't think that we understood at that time the limits that existed in rivers of this sort and the consequences of diversions that then left the river deficient from its environmental needs.
The idea to inhibit, to regulate the Murray comes about at the Corowa Conference in 1902. Let's talk about the benefactions and the damnations of dams. What's the story? How many are there, incidentally, at last count?
Well, some people say there's over 35,000 various sizes in the basin, but on the Murray system, the dams we have today, the major dams are Dartmouth, Hume, and Lake Victoria. Then on the Darling, we have the Menindee Lake system that are controlled. Within those structures, we capture most of the 9,000 gigalitres of storage that we have in the lower Murray system, and that's a pretty significant volume of water.
What's the good side of that story?
Well, the good side, I think, is that great wealth has been generated from those from that conservation. The social and economic values of that development, I think, are quite profound, and the communities of the Murray and the community of Adelaide rely very significantly on those developments. But I think it's led us to a conclusion that we're not going to have a pristine river Murray ever again. We're going to have what we hope to be a living, working river, which has to balance that trinity between healthy rivers, healthy catchments and healthy communities.
What's been the worst effect of the dams?
The worst effect has been to change the natural distribution and frequency of flooding and to replace it with a regulated flow, not out at flood level but at top of bank level in many cases in the summer, when previously it was a winter-spring flow. So that turning over of the natural order has had quite profound effect on the ecology of the riverine environment. And it's the area in which we have most to gain by focusing on what we can do to restore that.
And the function of the commission is to do what?
It's best described, I think, in two parts. It has a very clear service delivery role in the River Murray system, where it directs the operation and management of the works of water storage and conservation to provide the states with their shares of water under the agreement. And then in the whole of the basin, that is the greater part of the landmass of the basin, not just the southern River Murray system, it has a responsibility to provide to governments advice on land, water and environmental management to achieve equitable outcomes.
David, has given your long experience of the upper levels of the bureaucracy, you would know that that many regulatory bodies become captives of their industry. They finish up being manipulated by the pressure groups that really they should be disciplining. I'm wondering to what extent your relationship with the irrigators is helpful, healthy, appropriate.
I think it's all three, but I'd add another one, that it needs at times to be independent. The irrigation community is one in which I have personally huge, for which I have a huge respect. My whole life has been spent dealing with these people, and I'd avoid calling them the salt of the earth because that's not a very good metaphor these days, but these are the people who have made great use of the entitlements that have been created for the management of the system. What we're trying to encourage those people to see is that there is now an opportunity where governments are prepared to spend over $1 billion in the next 5 years to find a new balance between consumptive use for productive purposes and environmental use.
David, is this dinkum? Is this real new money? It's not just shoving the categories around, as governments, plural, so often do.
No, this is real money. This is new money. This is money that's coming about as a result of the Snowy Initiative. There's $150 million already on the table in terms of producing works that will improve the operation for environmental flows. And there's $500 million that the governments have recently announced to find a new balance, to achieve a new balance between water for consumption and water for environment. So it is the greatest opportunity that the irrigation community has ever seen.
A couple of years ago, for the first time in our little river, we noticed the dreaded carp had arrived. Now, carp are a symptom of the problems in your river system, aren't they? And this comes to some extent from the cold water pollution, the releases of water much colder than the natural flow from storage and dams, which I understand has an unhappy effect on native fish.
Yes, it is certainly an effect, although tends to be overstated as to the significance of the effect through the whole river system. We think that the construction of structures without fish passage probably has a more significant effect on impact on native fish species. We are currently engaged in a major program of providing fish passage at each of our major structures. The aim is from Goolwa to Hume over the next 5 years, and we'll achieve that.
These are little detours that will allow fish to get upstream and downstream.
Well, they're not so little in places. They're quite lengthy detours, but that's exactly what they are. They're graded structures that allow fish to enter in and to swim upstream as their testosterone demands, but to do it in a way that is consistent with native fish.
I knew we had trouble with testosterone with our sporting people. I didn't know we had trouble with it with our fish. I'm very shocked.
Well, I use that example because the Commission in the 1920s wanted to put fish passage in some of its structures, but the states were reluctant to fund the works, and probably it was a good reason, a good thing that they didn't fund too many of them, because what we knew about fish then was based on what we knew about salmon, and they're much more aggressive swimmers than our own native fish. So what we've got today is a series of structures that are tuned to the characteristics of our native fish, and we hope that will be a much greater impact than in changing.
Can they be detuned to be unhelpful to the bloody carp?
Well, in fact, they can. And there's an interesting story there that the Eureka Award just a couple of weeks ago, one of our operators at Turumbri Weir and a fish scientist from Arthur Ryler Institute won the prize. The prize being for a carp cage, because the operator had noticed that carp swim to the top of the water and will leap over a boundary. So he put another cage on the other side and they leap into that, where the native fish tend to swim deeper.
Now, David, I've got to let you go to enjoy your second retirement, but I guess you won't be breaking off your relationship with the Murray Darling.
Well, I hope not, Philip. I hope I can continue to offer something, and I'm quite sure they'll tell me when I can't.
At least you can go fishing.
That's right.
David Dole, Acting Chief Executive, Murray-Darling Basin Commission. This is LNL, travelling the Murray all this week on Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. You're not that Tim Fisher, so which Tim Fisher are you, Tim Fisher?
Well, I'm this Tim Fisher. I work with the Australian Conservation Foundation, have done for a while. And I suppose my special interest is water and specifically the Murray-Darling Basin.
You're the ACF's person on the ground, and you chose water, didn't you, as an occupation?
Oh, sort of. It seemed to me that there's been a hell of a lot of focus on terrestrial ecosystems and threatened species and so forth, but we've really neglected our rivers over the last century or so. And in southern and eastern Australia, I think you're really hard-pressed to find any rivers that you could hand on heart say are healthy.
Where are we sitting, Tim? Where have you brought me?
We're sitting just out of Albury, near the Albury Airport in a little billabong, well, not in the billabong, just on its banks, which has a bit of water in, which is probably unusual for a wetland in the Murray-Darling Basin right now. And you can hear the birds, and if you listen really carefully, you can hear a few frogs too, I'm sure.
Tim, do you have a long-standing emotional commitment to the Murray? Is there anything in your past that links you to this river?
Not really. I suppose with a lot of people that have become involved, you sort of... So once you start to hear about the true story, the history of development and the actual conservation status, if you like, of the Murray-Darling Basin and its many values, its wildlife and fish and vegetation and so on, then you start to go, oh, geez, this is a big issue. This is our greatest river system and it's in really, really deep strife.
I keep hearing glad tidings from bureaucrats involved in this attempt to rehabilitate the river. And I'm fascinated to hear from one very senior bureaucrat that he's never known a federal government to be so committed to good works. Do you agree with that?
I think it's probably a fair call in some respects. I think you have to look at the context a little here. I think that the community within the Murray-Darling Basin and in South Australia in particular has finally started to wake up that this is an urgent issue, that the Murray-Darling Basin is in poor shape, and a river where you've had just a trickle for probably a two-week period in the last 4 years that actually reached the sea, a river where half the native fish species are officially listed as threatened with extinction, and where you've got around about 1,000-kilometre stretch of River Redgum floodplain where the trees are turning up their toes through want of a drink and salinity, and where water quality is an issue. I mean, the issues have been brought to the fore, and it's in this time where I suppose we've seen the first significant step towards redressing the imbalance, which is the, as it's called, the first step.
Well, I'm glad you think it's stinking, because as you and I both know, governments, state and federal, have got an awful habit of saying an issue is dealt with once you've got a committee looking at it, or once you pass a piece of window dressing legislation. But you think there is a greater depth at state and federal level, if not to the river, at least to the commitment.
There's more reason for optimism now. We have a commitment that hasn't actually delivered any water yet, but it's probably got the best chance of doing so. By the same token, we've got some pretty staid bureaucracies and some pretty complex intergovernmental agreements, and there's a lot of hurdles yet to cross before we start to see some water return to the river. And of course we want it to rain a bit too. I mean, all this could be undone in a flash with some climate change. But I'd just say this too, that we still don't have anything that really resembles a long-term commitment to restoring the Murray to health. We just don't have it.
Are we looking at a genuinely bi or indeed tripartisan effort, or could this in some way become an election issue?
I think it's every chance it will become an election issue, especially in South Australia. Well, South Australians, I think, are very, very passionate about this. We know this from our market research and from just talking to people. Everyone in South Australia knows the Murray is not flush. Most people are worried about it, the vast majority. They've got poor water quality to deal with. They've got the worst of the ecological problems in the Murray-Darling Basin to deal with, or amongst the worst, certainly. They've got a Murray mouth which is constantly threatening to close over, and it's being dredged around the clock just to stop it from doing that, and that may not even work. It's got the famous Coorong, two-thirds of which is now dead. It's literally dead.
Okay, they could choose to punish a federal government, but would they find a better set of values or attitudes in Her Majesty's opposition?
It's a legitimate question for voters to ask, I think, especially in South Australia. They've all got a very keen interest in this. What we have is a significant difference between the parties right now. The science tells us that you really need at least 1,500 gigalitres or 1,500 billion litres in extra annual flow if the Murray is to have half a chance of being restored to
half
health.
Half a chance. So half even chance. That immense figure, that light years figure.
Yeah, to put it into context, that's a boost in flows roughly equivalent to about three times the water that Melbourne or Sydney uses annually. So it's a fair amount of water, but that also gives you an indication of how much water is actually taken out of the Murray-Darling Basin. It's an enormous amount.
So we're still in the process at this stage of getting blood from the stone, aren't we, in terms of finding the water from the heavens, from reallocation, from new procedures in farmings, from changes of emphasis in what we produce. All of this has to be negotiated with immense difficulty.
I think technically it's easy to find the water. Politically, it's hard. There are all sorts of sensitivities. You know, people might agree to water being returned to the environment, but they don't want it taken from their irrigation district, for example.
It's not so much a case of not in my backyard, but not out of my dam or not out of my irrigation allocation.
Yeah, my rice or dairy farm or whatever. And of course, we've had a lot of progress around the question of who pays. You know, basically, there is a commitment with at least this first step that, and with the National Water Initiative, that by and large the water will be acquired either as a water efficiency savings, if they're affordable, or through the water market. So there's an element of fairness now in the debate that wasn't there before. So a lot of, you know, the temperature's gone down of the debate. But I suppose I worry most about the thing being studied to death and analysed to death and bureaucratised to death, and that we may not see very rapid progress at all in recovering water for the Murray, when really we haven't got that much time.
Tell me about water usage. Tell me about the Murray-Darling, agriculture, inputs, outputs, the jargon, if you like, of statistics and water usage.
Oh, you need a book to write about it. I think it's a world of its own. There are losses and there are efficiencies and inefficiencies, and there's evaporation and all seepage and all sorts of stuff. The bottom line is, though, that we haven't made incredible progress in our practice of irrigated agriculture probably since ancient Egyptian times. There's still a hell of a lot of waste. We've got very inefficient gravity transport systems that lose a lot of water.
And even some of the water storages are, in a sense, doomed by where they are and how they were conceived.
Yeah, some water storages evaporate more than they hold, if that makes sense. Some of them are salinity time bombs, like Lake Victoria, for instance. And then on farm, you know, we still, by and large, practice pretty technically unadvanced flood irrigation. There's a lot of scope to do more with less. There's a lot of scope to get much more efficient, much smarter, much more technically advanced, and actually much more productive.
Tell me about
the ratio between food production and usage. You were, as we were driving out here, you were rattling off some propositions which I thought were quite extraordinary about, you know, 1% of the agricultural land in Australia producing 80% of the NOSH.
The irrigated agriculture is very intense agriculture, and it's very productive agriculture. 80% roughly of Australia's agricultural profits come from only 1% of Australia's land mass, and much of that
is an astonishing figure.
It is an astonishing figure, and much of that, or most of that, is from irrigated agriculture. Most of the rest would be high rainfall country, which is sort of naturally irrigated, I suppose.
And is most of that successfully irrigated area in the Murray-Darling?
Yes, 70% of Australia's irrigated product is in the Murray-Darling Basin. So you can't just scoff at it and say, well, let's not do it. Irrigated agriculture is here to stay. The question is, what's the right balance? What's the sustainable balance? And how do we achieve that?
How do you deal with the Rubik's Cube of vested interests?
I think it's got to come down to having a serious discussion about how to manage the change process in an equitable fashion. And I think the groundwork for that has been laid, really. I think over the last few years we've made enormous progress on this question. There are still people who are focusing on the fact that, you know, irrespective of the money on the table, the $500 million on the table, that you're still trying to take our water and you shouldn't. I think that some people, most people probably in irrigated agriculture, are now starting to think, well, here's an opportunity, $500 million of investment to deliver a win-win outcome.
Let me ask you a couple of really woody questions. How do you get water out of the Murray into, say, the Coorong? How do you get it into the Hatton Lakes? How do you actually get the water where it's ecologically most needed, having made the decision to do so?
Well, that's a tricky one because it's actually very hard.
I mean, you can't just turn on a tap, can you, or run a hose?
Well, you can turn some pretty big taps and that's going to help. But I think the real challenge is in managing whatever modest amounts of water the environment manages to get to best effect. And that's going to need a lot of very clever intervention. It's not just a matter of, oh, we'll just let it dribble down. To get the best effect, we need to recreate some of the natural components of the natural flow regime. In particular, flooding flows that would reach low-lying areas, floodplains, and maintain what we call as the lateral connectivity between the river and its floodplains. Yeah. The floodplains are really important as sources of food and nutrients for the river, and the river is very important for the health of the floodplains. You know, our red gums, which are probably more identifiably Australian than any other tree, they're floodplain species by and large. And our magnificent river red gums, and there's plenty of them looking pretty healthy right here. But you go down to the South Australian and parts of the Murray, and they're very, very sick indeed. So trying to get a flood event in, the Chowwilla floodplain in South Australia means that you will have to synchronise very tightly releases from 2, 3, 4 water storages. And that's going to take some very active management. We've got to get very clever about it. Also, it might mean, too, that one year the environment share might be loaned to irrigated agriculture, and then paid back in the next year, or indeed just carried over. So in year two, you get twice as much water and you get twice the benefit from it.
How important a part of the solution is the theory and the practice of selling water rights, trading water?
Water trade is very important. That's not to say that it can't have some negative environmental impacts. It can. And I actually wish we'd get more thought put into the rules and regulations governing water trade so that we can feel safer about the impacts of trade on the environment. But having said that, if you're a farmer and you're growing irrigated pasture, say, on country that with a high water table, with salinity starting to emerge all over the place. What you don't need is the option where you can't sell that water without selling the farm as well, where the next farmer has to come and be prepared to pay to buy a liability. You need to be able to transfer water, and I think that if people want to leave the industry, they need to be able to leave it gracefully.
Tim, you've been a part of the agreement on the Victorian side of the Murray between farmers, irrigators and the government to achieve the 200 gigalitres of water that needs to be saved in the state. In broad brush terms, can you explain that agreement and how it's meant to work?
The agreement hasn't quite got to 200 gigalitres, but it's most of the way there. Part of the water that is issued to irrigated agriculture each year, or most years, is water called sales water. It's what's called a low reliability product. It's available if there's enough water in the storages.
It's hypothetical water, in a sense.
Oh, well, this year it is. Yeah. Previous years, there's been plenty of it often. That water has been sort of part of a pool of water available on a first-in, best-dressed basis. Now that's going to be changed to an individual tradable entitlement, which is real value to the people who are going to own this product. What we felt was that we needed a bit of a
so it
a
moves
fair deal
from an
out of
entitlement
that.
To something you actually legally own.
That's right, and that can be legally traded. That's a benefit to those farmers who will own that product. What we felt was that something that previously been wholly in the public domain, if it's been given away in that fashion, then the environment really should get a share of it. What we managed to get was 20%, and that's, I suppose, the lion's share of the water that's been found to date.
What are you going to do with your 20%, if and when you get it?
Going to look after it very carefully and make sure we can get the best environmental benefits we can out of it.
Who will have control over this 20%, this marvellous theoretical virtual water flow?
We don't know yet, and that's the worrying. That's one of the things that's worrying me right now. We don't yet have an agreement by the Murray-Darling Basin states and the Commonwealth about how that water will be managed and controlled to best effect. The worst case scenario, I suppose, is that each state or each catchment manages the water for their own individual interests. What we really need is someone with an overview, someone entrusted to manage the water on the basis of, on behalf of, all of the rivers of the southern Murray-Darling Basin and potentially down the track the entire Murray-Darling Basin. That requires someone to be given the powers to rise above the particular interests or vested interests of each particular state or valley.
Where are we going to find this paragon?
We have the basis for it in the Murray-Darling Agreement. And what I'm hoping is that these states and the Commonwealth can be mature enough to look at divesting themselves of that total control and entrusting a purpose-built environmental trust, if you like, to manage that water for the best interests of the Murray and its tributaries.
Well, on behalf of the River Red Gums and the Murray, those big fish, what are they called?
Murray cod.
Murray cod. I thank you for your time with us, Tim, and let me remind the listener who you are. You're the other Tim Fisher. You're the Tim Fisher from the Australian Conservation Foundation. And that's it for the first LNL from the Murray. On our next, we'll be talking to some of the farmers that Tim's been negotiating with and the irrigators on both sides of the river. See you then. That's it for the first week of our summer program, but join us next week as the journey along the Murray continues.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.